Well, some of you may remember the horrible spectacle during the 2004 election campaign of a whole, you know, army of forestry workers shaking hands with John Howard because John Howard wasn't going, the, you know, Liberal Prime Minister of the time wasn't going to sell their jobs down the river. And this, I think, coupled with the defeat of the Labor government led by, well, sorry, not the government, the opposition led by Mark Latham, seemed to suggest at the time, you know, the inherent conservatism of the Australian working class, that they would rather embrace, you know, someone like John Howard than anyone else, and that the fact that no one could see, you know, the fact that Australian workers couldn't even, you know, be bothered to get off their asses and vote out the Howard government that, you know, so many people despised, seemed to suggest their sort of inherent conservatism. And certainly at the time, people argued those kinds of things. And I think that image of those workers, you know, shaking hands with John Howard really reinforced the stereotype of the Australian worker as a slothful, complacent, stupidly content with their white goods, picket fences and souped-up cars. And, of course, I think this stereotype is brandished by, I think, some really incorrigible elitists. And they use the stereotype to try and deny the, you know, the potential power and radicalism of the Australian working class as a whole. But also, you know, the stereotype flows through to pretty much any worker in the West that has access to such, you know, wonders of capitalism as a car, a house and a picket fence. But these elitist ideas aren't really so removed from the theoretical conception of the Western working class, which is promulgated by many on the left today, this idea that the Western working class forms some kind of labour aristocracy. And the proponents of this theory draw upon, you know, Lenin himself to uphold this theory and to argue that, you know, if not all Western workers or a section of Western workers are bought off by imperialism and thereby form an aristocracy of labour. The key proponents of this theory in Australia are probably on the far left, at any rate, the Democratic Socialist Party. In this talk, I'm going to be drawing on principally on a whole series of essays written by one of their leading members, Jonathan Strauss, who's written, I think, a whole thesis about the labour aristocracy and the Australian labour movement. But his sort of principal, argument, and echoing, you know, some of the formulations of Lenin, which I'm going to return to in a moment, he says that the class collaborationist policies amongst workers express the interests of a relatively privileged stratum of workers who receive the benefits supported by monopoly super profits. They also argue that because there's this stratum of workers that are bought off by the super profits of imperialism, that the conservatism of the ALP actually reflects their interests and is driven by this layer inside the working class. And Peter Boyle, another leading member of the DSP, has even gone so far as to argue that racism and xenophobia has been revived and that the material basis for this is the relative privilege of workers in imperialist countries. And, of course, these ideas aren't particularly new, and they've found echoes, you know, in many of the debates about Australian labour history, and have been taken up to, you know, very, you know, different ways by various Australian labour historians. One I will point to is Humphrey McQueen, because his book, A New Britannia, was quite controversial on the left. I remember when it came up at a discussion about in a labour history when I was in Sydney that people were shuddering about the impact of this particular book. But McQueen argued in his book that particularly in 19th century Australia, Australian society was characterised by a sort of petty bourgeois radicalism that reflected the aspirations and actual possibilities of social mobility in Australia that didn't exist in, you know, Europe at the same time, or Britain. And therefore, the trade unions that formed were conservative by nature and were based upon the idea of sort of self-advancement. And in McQueen's, Humphrey McQueen's book, he makes much of the fact, for example, that a lot of Australian working class households could afford things like pianos, which was an emblem and a symbol of their relative wealth and security and their aspiration to be, you know, to sort of have this sort of bourgeois life. But all of these theories, in one way or another, have in common that there is a section of the working class or the working class as a whole, particularly in the West and in countries like Australia, that are bought off, and have some interest in promoting the status quo and promoting, capitalist social relations. But once you start to argue that, you know, that Western workers are bought off in this kind of way, or that, you know, Western workers form some kind of labour aristocracy, or even only some narrow stratum, well, then it's not such a leap to start suggesting other things such as that first world workers live off the backs of the third world. I think this argument flows quite, you know, naturally on from this in many ways. And that white workers benefit from the exploitation of black workers, and that male workers benefit at the expense of women workers, and, you know, and this can go on and on. And I think all these arguments provide a theoretical gloss to the idea that the working class in the West is incapable of carrying out any social revolution or fundamental challenge to capitalism. So I want to argue in this talk that this theory is mistaken, and an actual fact this is not the case, that Western workers are just as capable of carrying out revolutionary actions as their contemporaries in the third world. And in fact, this idea that some of them are bought, you know, sections or all of them are bought off by imperialism is, I think, quite wrong. So I want to actually first start by examining the so-called Marxist orthodoxy, because a lot of the so-called strength of this theory rests upon that, you know, greats like Engels and Lenin argued this. So I want to examine that, and then I want to go on to argue the actual basis for reformist ideas and, you know, current conservatism in the working class in some Western countries is actually based, lies with the trade union bureaucracy, and this is the material basis for reformist ideas in the working class. So firstly, I want to turn to looking at Marx and Engels, because Marx used the term labour aristocrat in 1850 in a reference to the decline of the Chartists. And he said it in this way. He said, "The petty bourgeois who still belong to the party, allied with the aristocracy of workers, form a purely democratic wing whose programme is limited to the People's Charter and some other petty bourgeois reforms. The mass of workers living under really proletarian conditions belong to the revolutionary wing of the Chartists." So, you know, trying to suggest that there was a sort of conservative layer of workers that had distinct separate interests to the revolutionary wing of the working class. Engels developed this idea further. In the 1880s, he described England as a country in which the working class has shared more than anywhere else in the advantages of the immense expansion of large-scale industry. Nor could it have been otherwise in England that ruled the world market. And certainly while Engels employed the term more than Marx, there is no one clear definition of a labour aristocrat or the method by which, you know, workers are supposed to have been bought off or share in the so-called feast the expansion of the English Empire was supposed to provide. And at no point did Engels clarify even who was supposed to comprise this layer of labour aristocrats. At various points it seems as if he used the term as a reference to trade union leaders, while at other times it was a reference to highly skilled workers organised into craft unions such as engineers, carpenters, joiners, bricklayers, etc. So obviously Marx and Engels were grappling with a real political problem, and particularly, you know, the rise of mass reformism in Britain in the second half of the 19th century was a real political problem for, you know, people who dedicated their lives to the revolutionary overthrow of capitalism. However, I think their few remarks about the labour aristocracy do not provide an adequate explanation of reformism, in the development of reformism, particularly during this period in Britain. And I think it's difficult to claim that the labour aristocracy is a key, you know, based on these few fleeting references, is actually a key part of Marxist orthodoxy from these few remarks. So now I want to turn and look at Lenin, because Lenin did actually do more to develop the theory and to try and suggest, flesh it out some more. Because once again, the theory, the development of the theory for Lenin was an impetus to try and explain the devastating impact of mass reformism on the working class in the form of the collapse of the Second International, the capitulation to imperialism, and then later on some of the impact of the reformist politics on, you know, the squashing of revolutionary movements, particularly in Germany. So, but Lenin, you know, employs the term principally in his pamphlet on imperialism, where he castigates the stratum of workers turned bourgeois, or the labour aristocracy, the principal prop of the Second International, the real agents of the bourgeoisie in the working class, the real vehicles of reformism and chauvinism. And I want people to keep those phrases in your mind, because hopefully they will jar when we start to actually unpick and examine what the labour aristocracy is actually meant to be. Lenin goes on to outline that the material basis of the labour aristocracy is the super profits accumulated by an imperialist country. These profits are defined as being over and above what the capitalists can squeeze from workers in their own country under normal sort of capitalist relations. These super profits make it possible to bribe labour leaders and the upper stratum of the working class into an acceptance of capitalism, even, you know, or an active promotion in some, you know, in some cases. And they've been bribed out of, you know, and Lenin, you know, spells this out in a number of different ways. He says, but they've been bribed out of imperial super profits and converted into the watchdogs of capitalism, the corruptors of the labour movement. Once again, keep those phrases in your mind. And he goes on to say, particularly in his pamphlet on imperialism, that this privileged upper stratum of the proletariat in imperialist countries lives partly at the expense of the hundreds of millions of in the uncivilized nations. We've heard some of those arguments before. And in terms of as far as I could discover, the closest that Lenin actually comes to defining who these people are is a reference in, I think it was in the imperialism pamphlet, where he says, the bulk of the membership of the people who form the labour aristocracy, the bulk of the membership come from cooperatives, from the trade unions, of sporting clubs and numerous religious sects. And like I said before, that was the closest definition I could find where Lenin actually starts to define who this upper stratum of labour aristocrats is supposed to be. But of course, the other, you know, the other usage of the term that Lenin, when he uses labour aristocrat, is often used in reference to the Kautsky and the reformist leaders. I think we have to be clear that Lenin's pamphlet, where he sort of spells out these on imperialism, and there's a few other smaller pamphlets that he wrote about the collapse of the Second International, where he spells these ideas out, you know, were, as he said, he referred to the imperialism pamphlet, a popular outline, trying to make the bear sort of sketch out, you know, the reasons behind the First World War and the devastation that it had, both in terms of, you know, real devastation, but the political devastation that it wrought in terms of the collapse of the Second International. But I think just even from this brief description, you know, I've tried to pick out the key points where Lenin argues this, about the labour aristocracy, it's quite clear that the late Lenin's theory was hardly very exhaustive or particularly precise in the way in which he argued this. And I think it actually has a series of holes which I want to go through and investigate in terms of how the theory works out. The first question then is, well, actually, who comprises the labour aristocracy? Who makes up this stratum of workers that are supposed to be the watchdogs of capitalism, the corruptors of the rest of the labour movement, the break on the revolutionary aspirations of the other sections of the working class? And like I said before, when Lenin actually used the term labour aristocrat, most of the time he used it, he was referring to people like Kautsky, who was leader of the German Social Democratic Party and, you know, someone who capitulated to imperialism and supported the war and all the rest of it. And, you know, it's certainly the case that people like Kautsky did promote reformist ideas amongst workers. But actually, Lenin's conception of the labour aristocracy is a lot more objectionable when you consider the sections of the working class that it's actually also meant to include. And I think one of the first and obvious contradictions in Lenin's formulation about the labour aristocracy as applied to a stratum of workers is that actually some of the same skilled workers that Engels referred to, and Lenin builds on some of the remarks that Engels made about the labour aristocracy, some of these very skilled workers were the same skilled workers that were organised by the Bolshevik Party and actually led, you know, the Russian working class during the revolution of 1917. I mean, you only have to think of the skilled workers of the Vyborg district in places like Petrograd, you know, the vanguard of the revolutionary Russian working class. But according to Engels and Lenin's formulations, that these people would form some kind of aristocracy of labour, and they're the watchdogs of bourgeois order. But even in countries where reformist politics were more developed than Russia, you know, it was clear that skilled workers and, you know, reasonably, relatively well-paid, well-off skilled workers were actually the basis of many of the revolutionary movements. I mean, you have to think of things like the engineers in Turin who were devoured Gramsci's paper, you know, L'Ordine Nuovo, and had the relationship, formed the Communist Party later on, that these workers would fall into the category of labour aristocrats according to the definition that had been set up by Engels and Lenin. And while Lenin never commented on this contradiction, I think that it's worth now looking at some of the people who have tried to continue on the theory and promote and propagate the theory of the labour aristocracy to see how they define, you know, who this stratum of workers are and who are the, you know, who join the ranks of these so-called capitalist watchdogs. Okay, so back to Jonathan Strauss. Well, the closest that I could find in Strauss's long writings about the labour aristocracy in Australia is the closest I could come to finding a definition was the following statement, where he says that the labour aristocracy, and it's a fairly convoluted sentence, so bear with me, the labour aristocracy made up the main part of union membership, which was less than 10% of workers for all but a few years from the middle of the 1880s, and it peaked around 1891, and a little more than 20% of workers in New South Wales, Victoria, and 4% in South Australia. So basically what I think he's saying here is that, you know, the bulk of unionised workers in Australia were labour aristocrats of some kind. But actually, during this time in Australia, around 1880s to 1890s, there were both skilled and unskilled workers that had formed unions. And it wasn't just limited to, you know, craft unions or anything like it. And so if this is the case, then, this is factually the case, then it seems like Strauss is suggesting that simply being organised into a union makes you a potential candidate for a labour aristocrat. And he doesn't just say this once either. He approvingly refers to American academics who have done much to promote the theory of the labour aristocracy, where they say quite explicitly that the labour aristocracy includes unionised skilled workers, workers in privileged branches of industry, office employees, producers of luxury goods, or more extensively, the bulk of organised workers. So there you go. So according to Strauss, the labour aristocracy, one of the other things that Strauss adds on to his definition, and I think you can start to see some of the problems with this whole theory where it takes you, is that Strauss says that one of the things that defines the labour aristocracy is that it actually secures for itself as part of its bribe, which I'm going to turn to in a bit more detail, a system of concessions in the condition of the class struggle by capital to the working class. So he's suggesting that that actually one of the parts of the bribe that you get from the bosses in terms of buying your loyalty to capitalism is more favourable to train to conduct your bit of the class struggle. The bosses will let you go and strike more. You know, this doesn't actually spell out the implications, but I think you can sort of see them. But really what it means is that if you're a worker, you're really damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. Because according to this logic, if you're in a badly paid, shittily conditioned section of the working class that engages in some kind of struggle to improve your conditions, your wages, and all the rest of it, and you're actually successful and you actually improve your wages and conditions and your security of employment and all these kinds of things, well, then actually you're propelling yourself into the ranks of the labour aristocracy. And you think of historical examples like the Builders' Labourers Federation, who did actually start off as badly organised, crap conditions, all the rest of it, and organised and improved their conditions and became some of the best paid workers, you know, in the Australian, amongst Australian workers. Well, as soon as they have some success, they've become, you know, labour aristocrats according to this logic. But I think even the, you know, history of the Australian labour movement is one that refutes the idea that there's some kind of upper stratum of workers that are promoting pro-capitalist ideas to other workers. Because you only have to think of, you know, unions like the Australian Workers' Union, which is a union of largely unskilled workers, that was notorious for its advocacy of arbitration and moderation and those kinds of things. And on the other hand, there's been, you know, craft unions or, you know, unions organised around a particular skill that were quite industrially militant. And finally, in terms of the way in which the debate has flowed in Australia, there's one of the key arguments that people who propose the labour aristocracy is that Australia is and was some kind of paradise for workers, that somehow, you know, and you can see it in the writings of Humphrey McQueen, that certain aspirational quality that is supposed to be embodied in the Australian working class, that you can move forward, get ahead more easily in Australia because it's this wonderful land of plenty. But, and that's certainly some part of this whole idea helps sustain some of the myths of the labour aristocracy. But I think the reality is quite different. Ray Markey, who wrote a book on the formation of the New South Wales Labour Party, comments that actually in this period of the sort of later half of the 19th century, that the level of material prosperity in the 1880s for skilled and unskilled urban workers warrants a good deal less optimism than many contemporaries or historians have believed. So And I think that, you know, if you read about some of the conditions of workers at this period of time, you get to see that actually they were just as badly treated and badly off as their contemporaries in the rest of the world. So to sum up this section, any attempt to define the labour aristocracy encounters, I think, two key problems. Well, firstly, that the workers that Engels and Lenin would suggest are part of the labour aristocracy have actually participated in immense and profound revolutionary movements in a number of countries in the West. And that the other element of the trying to define a labour aristocracy promoted by those who can see themselves continuing on in Engels and Lenin's footsteps, you know, would suggest that actually the very struggles that workers engage in to improve their conditions, to stand up to their bosses, to, you know, to do that basic thing of, you know, banding together to improve their lot, actually this is the basis for propelling them into the ranks of the labour aristocracy, you know, and, you know, and the basis by which they might even be bribed by into supporting or accepting capitalism. Well, and this brings me on to the second element of the theory of the labour aristocracy, the nature of the bribe. Because I've already discussed one element of the bribe as suggested by Jonathan Strauss, but I think it's really worth raising here Tony Clift's criticisms of Lenin's whole idea of the labour aristocracy. Because Tony Clift critiqued Lenin's idea of the labour aristocracy in his pamphlet on the economic roots of reformism. And the first question that Clift proposes is, well, how does this so-called bribe actually work? Because, as he points out, no self-respecting boss says to their workers, I've made high profits this year, so I'm ready to give you higher wages. In Lenin's, and I think it's worth pointing out here as well, that in Lenin's in the pamphlet on imperialism, Lenin actually says that the mechanism of the bribe is a secondary question. But I think that if the theory is to have any legs and to be able to stand up on its own merits, then surely this mechanism of how workers are bribed has to have some kind of validity and be explained. But the other element of the argument that Tony Clift makes in terms of refuting the idea that workers are bribed by imperialism is to point out that actually imperialist expansion, the export of capital, you know, the development of colonies and, you know, the whole imperialist infrastructure can have, you know, can have a big impact on workers in imperialist countries by creating jobs in the industries that service imperialism, railways, trains, you know, those kinds of things. But actually, it doesn't raise up just a limited strata of workers. Actually, it has an effect on the working class as a whole. And it doesn't, and actually, the tendency is not to create a greater disparity between unskilled or skilled workers, but actually to start to close that gap. Because what Clift points out is that a rise in wages and living standards for one section of workers inevitably leads to a rise across the class as a whole. The higher the general standard of living, including educational level, the easier it is for unskilled workers to become semi-skilled or skilled, and the easier it is for workers to learn a skill and then, you know, it helps close the differential between skilled and unskilled workers, which is part of the basis of, you know, the labour aristocracy theory. But and I think the other aspect of, you know, looking at, you know, workers' standard living is that the standard of living that workers achieve is not something that's just given out by bosses. Usually it involves some kind of bitter struggle between workers and bosses to improve the conditions of workers, and workers have to force these concessions out of bosses. So really any attempt to improve living standards inevitably involves some kind of class struggle. I think a good example of this in Australia is the struggle for the eight-hour day. This was started by a craft union, the stonemasons. You know, they raised the demand for an eight-hour day, and it was, led by a well-organised, highly skilled, relatively well-paid section of the working class. But the demands rapidly spread across the working class in Australia, and even though it might have taken 20 or 25 years for it to be realised, you know, in a variety of different industries, it was something that eventually flowed through to a lot of different sections of the working class, both skilled and unskilled. But also, the other thing to point out is that the eight-hour day became something that was that the bosses tried to roll back in whatever way that they could, and that there was, you know, ongoing struggles to try and maintain and hold on to the eight-hour day once it had actually been won. So it wasn't like this thing that, you know, bosses just gave out to workers as part of take this 8-hour day, accept capitalism and shut up. It was actually something that became a key pivot in the struggle, class struggle in Australia. And there's, I mean, the other element in terms of, you know, the role of imperialist expansion, you know, bribing some section of the working class, is that it is true that, you know, the expansion of imperialist economies can provide the basis for, you know, secure employment, more jobs, and therefore the ability of workers to fight for higher living standards and all the rest of it. But also imperialist expansion or maintaining an empire can lead to vicious anti-working class agendas. And I think you only have to think of the United States today to sort of see how this has flowed through. Yesterday, Joe Allen, in his talk about Obama, referred to the fact that real wages in the United States have not gone up since 1972. That's a long time for wages to be stagnating. And so really, you know, real wages have fallen. But, and it looks like this process is set to continue. Joel Geyer, in one of his many articles, he's an American socialist, in one of his many articles about the economic crisis, suggests that one of the strategies that the US ruling class will employ to try and dig themselves out of the crisis and also, you know, maintain the fortunes of their empire is to try and turn the US into a low-wage economy. So, you know, Walmart wages will become the norm, or, you know, try to at any rate. And I think that you can, you know, see here that it's hardly like imperialist expansion or the US bourgeoisie's attempts to maintain their empire has meant that there's been some section of workers or workers as a whole in the US that have benefited from this. Actually, we've seen an absolutely savaging of working class living standards and conditions. And finally, in terms of refuting this argument about the bribe of imperial super profits and all the rest of it, we only have to look at, I think, the quite impressive tradition of anti-imperialist struggles, particularly waged by Australian workers, but by, you know, numerous workers in the West, in Western countries, against, you know, against imperialism. So, for example, the massive struggles against World War I that, you know, culminated in revolutions in several countries, but, you know, even have to think of the struggles in Australia, the Vietnam War, the, you know, this, the important stand that workers took against that, the, you know, in Australia, the support for Indonesian independence, and even, you know, the support of Australian workers for things like Aboriginal rights and all the rest of it. All of this has an important anti-imperialist dynamic that cuts against, support for the status quo and, you know, the role of Australian imperialism. And I think when you actually weigh it up, it's quite an impressive tradition. To sum up, well, in this particular section about the bribe, imperialist expansion can be the basis for a rise in living standards across the class, but it's across the class and not just for a minority of so-called labour aristocrats. And I think that, you know, so-called labour aristocrats, however you define them, have been part of important and impressive anti-imperialist struggles, which suggests that they're not bribed into supporting, you know, things like Australian or US imperialism. So, well, finally then, to turn and look at, well, what is the basis for reformist ideas inside the working class? Because this is the question that both Engels and Lenin were trying to answer and grapple with when they wrote their respective pamphlets and works on this question. And, well, I would argue that actually it's the trade union bureaucracy that is the basis for transmitting reformist ideas into the working class. And unlike so-called labour aristocrats, they are actually an identifiable and separate social layer that has their own material interests. And I think it's trade union bureaucrats that are the real agents of the bourgeoisie and the working class and the watchdogs of capitalist order. And it's precisely because they have their own particular interests that they can fulfil this role. Because when you think about it, they are a layer of people between the two main contending classes, workers and bosses, that their role is to really negotiate the rate of exploitation that they have, you know, in terms of representing their members in the unions to the bosses and trying to secure a better deal for, you know, the going rate of exploitation. But they have absolutely no interest in abolishing exploitation as workers do, because their whole position rests on exploitation continuing day to day. You think about it, that their whole, you know, that they can be, you know, you know, they can be at one level, you know, concerned to maintain their membership, to be able to secure a few benefits for the workers to make sure that they can maintain a position in a functioning union, but they can also be fairly hostile to attempts by the bosses to try and undermine or undermine their ability to organise or take away their rights to organise workers, as we've seen in some of the debates with work choices. And I think that the Australian Labor Party, particularly in Australia, is the political expression of this particular social layer, the trade union bureaucracy. And it's not an aristocratic strata inside the working class, as the DSP would suggest. And that actually the conservatism of the Labor Party reflects the essentially reformist nature of the trade union bureaucracy as it negotiates, you know, the rate of exploitation and really negotiates in a framework that totally accepts capitalist social relations. And I think their role becomes really clear when you examine campaigns like the recent campaign against the Hale government's work choices law. And I remember that, you know, you want another image that suggests the real nature of where reformist ideas come from in Australia. Think of that big demonstration that happened at the MCG, it was in 2006 or 2007. And, you know, that those thousands of workers assembled to protest and, stand up for your rights at work, and the slogan that had been the cornerstone of the campaign, you know, your rights at work worth fighting for, was the fighting bit was removed and it was changed to your rights at work worth voting for as part of, you know, the attempts of the trade union bureaucracy to channel the anger, resentment, fear that workers might have had about this really savage attack on their living standards and ability to organise into voting for Kevin Rudd, Julia Gillard, who we've now seen has really simply reworked work choices and pumped it out in a slightly different way. But I think when you see that it's the trade union bureaucracy that is the basis for reformist ideas in the working class, well, then it does, I think, raise the question of the importance of revolutionary leadership in terms of standing up to these reformist ideas and actually organising workers to realise their potential to challenge capitalism in a more fundamental way. And that actually, I think the development of revolutionary leadership, in any country really, will be key to whether or not workers can realise their potential of being able to fundamentally challenge the system and eventually get rid of it altogether. So, to conclude, for the proponents of the labour aristocracy theory, the actions of the working class in solidarity with struggles in the Third World or in other countries that aren't considered to be part of the West can only simply be an act of charity, that workers have to act against their own interests in order to support things like, you know, struggles against the Vietnam War, the struggles against the First World War, for example. And it means that trying to organise or be involved in workers' struggles in the West can only be, at best, some kind of moral equation, you know, where you try and, you know, appeal to the better nature of or the better senses of workers to try and engage in some kind of struggle, rather than something that, you know, that is inherent to the working class, actually stand up for their own interest and resist things like imperialist slaughter or the exploitation and ill treatment of their brothers and sisters in other parts of the world. And I think that as we enter into this new period of economic crisis and political turmoil, we'll see that the working class will have to engage, the Western working class will have to engage in, I think, similar, you know, cataclysmic battles to stand up for its rights, to stand up for its conditions and to resist the ravages of the system, the same as, you know, the workers in other parts of the world will. And I think that that solidarity with workers in the Third World and, the actions of Western working class will be part of the key battles of the future to actually get rid of capitalism more fundamentally.